Hey everyone, welcome to the Celtic Life International podcast, or CLIP for short, where we provide you with just a slice of Celtic life. Today's sponsor is Sheenco Travel. Launched in 2012 under the name Shamrock Vacations, today Sheenco Travel is the leading name in luxury travel to Ireland and the UK, and they've also just launched a brand new travel franchise in the US. To find out more about that, go to sheencotravel.com. Hey, welcome to the third episode of CLIP, and today our regular co-host Stephen Patrick Clare, editor-in-chief, is taking a bit of a sabbatical as we just finished up the production run of the latest issue. So joining me today is associate editor Caitlin Mearns. Caitlin, how's it going?
I'm good. How are you, Chris?
Not too bad. We just had a productive meeting just before we started recording today with the whole team.
Yeah, I think it was the first one we've ever done.
Together? Like, yeah, at least a Zoom call, like the whole crowd. Yeah, that's definitely true. Things are moving a little differently now that we have Siobhan on the team.
Yep.
We have a few things coming down the pipeline that sound fairly exciting. We won't spoil them now so as to not promise anything we don't deliver on later. But keep an eye on this space. We'll have news soon of anything new that will pique your fancy. So, Caitlin, you did this issue's cover story, that's correct?
I sure did. It was fun.
For people who haven't read the article yet, it's about Dress to Kilt, which is an event that happens, I believe, in New York?
Yeah, it's in New York every year.
For the listeners who haven't read it yet, tell me a bit about it.
So when I didn't actually know much about the Dress to Kilt event before Stephen had pitched the story idea to me and told me he wanted me to do the cover story. When I did my interview with one of the co-founders, his name is Jeffrey Scott Carroll, I kind of went in blind and I didn't really know what to expect, but he was so generous with information. My interview was about an hour and 30 minutes.
Wow.
He had a lot to say. He was very interesting. He was very impassioned. It was quite the thing to transcribe, I will say that. But he was really an interesting man to listen to. I was really lucky because originally the story was going to be kind of a bigger thing. But I decided because of how strong that interview was, I really wanted to make it the crux of the story. So I was lucky in that I got to, in one way or another, include everything he said. But some of it, it was just like a passing comment instead of really expounding upon it. But yeah, he was super interesting to listen to and a funny guy. He had me kind of laughing a few times.
When I read the article, I got the sense that he's someone who holds a lively conversation for sure. And he also co-founded that with the late, great Sean Connery, right?
Yeah, that did come up. He was very touched when I first brought up Sir Sean Connery. And I can never say that without kind of lisping.
We'll get it in post.
Yeah, he got really sad because he said it still doesn't feel right to say the late, you know, and he started listing all of these nicknames that he had for him when they were friends throughout the years. And it was quite touching and quite sad. But this event is going to be, it's very much going to honor the Connery family and Sean Connery. So I think it's been quite cathartic for him to be able to kind of celebrate his friend and his coworker and his partner.
Absolutely. That kind of thing. You got to have those ways to say goodbye in a formal way sometimes to really let that sink in and to be able to cope with the loss, right? And
yeah, for sure.
So Sean Connery isn't just, it's not just somebody that Mr. Carroll knows. This is a man who touched a lot of lives for many decades. So this is also a great opportunity for people who attend the event to kind of say goodbye to him as well, right?
Yeah, and I touched on that a bit in the story. A number of people are going to be coming up before the actual, just a little side thing, Dress to Kilt is a fashion show and charity event. So before people start walking the runway, they're going to have a number of people come up and honor a memory with Sir Sean Connery. So I think that's quite sweet as well.
Mm-hmm. That sounds great. So you mentioned that you basically got to talk about everything, but I was going to ask if there's anything in particular from your interview that you didn't get to cover as much as you'd have liked to that you could expand upon here, because I think this is the perfect space for us writers to be like, gosh, I couldn't quite fit that in to the piece to still get that information out there into the world somewhere. So was there anything in particular you'd like to expound upon?
I mean, I do feel good about everything that I got into the story. One thing I wish I had have had more time or words to talk about would have been the inclusion of the Indigenous creators. Mm-hmm. So that does take up a percentage of the story, but I had reached out to a couple of other designers and models who just didn't get back in time. And I kind of wanted to make that the meat of it, but I wasn't able to. I'm glad that I got some of it in there anyway. But of course, like historically, what I've learned is that there is a lot of similarities between Indigenous tribes in North America and the Scottish clans. So kind of looking at that was really interesting. Jeffrey told me, or Mr. Carroll told me, that, you know, no one's ever really looked at that. No one's ever really talked about that. And so I'm really glad that we got to in any way, you know?
Mm-hmm. It was a compelling part of the piece.
Mm.
That covers the big story you wrote for the issue. What were some of the pieces that you didn't write that kind of clicked with you?
I mean, there were so many really good ones in this issue, but I think my personal favorite piece from this issue was the one our coworker Rebecca Dingwall wrote, which was on the Witches of Scotland, which was super interesting.
It was, because, you know, I see that and it's like, oh, it's going to be a fun history lesson about all the weird misconceptions we had in the spooky stories. But no, it is a very serious look at the tragedy that befell so many Scottish women that has still not been really addressed or corrected. Like, it's a much more weighty piece than I expected. I was really fascinated reading it.
Yeah, she did an incredible job. Very thorough. It explained the legalities around it historically and where we are today. It was a super interesting and compelling piece.
I agree. And we're lucky. We actually have a piece from Rebecca's interview with Claire discussing this topic, and why don't we cut to that now?
Sounds good.
What are some of the things that you have learned over the course of this research and doing your podcast? Is there anything that has really like surprised or shocked you that you didn't anticipate?
That's a good question. Anything surprised me? I probably didn't expect the number of people who are interested in the witch trials and have been pursuing their own inquiries. I mean, independent of the historians, obviously there are historians that do that, but just people who privately have set about trying to memorialise the women and men. And also the number of people who have, using their own local money, put up markers to where women were killed as witches. There are stones all over Scotland marking where people were killed as witches. But it's only been through modern day locals finding out the stories and doing those things themselves. So it surprised me that so many people are so passionate about it.
Yeah, and that's it's really inspiring, because like I know, like when I was in my undergrad, I took an elective called Witchcraft in Early Modern Europe that was all about like the witch trials of that period.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And it was always something that I had been interested in, but I wasn't able to, like, I didn't really know that much about it. And it was a really popular course too. I feel like I went to a pretty small university, and I feel lucky that I was able to do that, because I was like, wow, like there's so much, like obviously I knew it was something that happened, but I didn't fully realize how widespread it was and how like horrific it really was for a lot of these people involved. Like you'd said about like the torture, and some of it was so extremely intense, you know, led to so many false confessions. And it I feel like that class really like ended up like affecting me and kind of like changed my perspective, especially like looking at like criminal justice today and how it works. And
I mean, false confessions were a thing then, they're still a thing now. You only now, when people see watch like Making a Murderer and they see Brendan Dassey's false confession, mm-hmm. and they see how easy it is to get people to confess to things that they never did, even when they're not torturing them. Mm-hmm. And once people confess to things, it seems society says, oh, well, you've confessed now. You wouldn't confess if it wasn't true. Not realising that, in fact, so many people do. And there have been so many miscarriages of justice throughout the centuries, right up till now, because people are convicted on false confessions. So yeah, in terms of criminal justice, it has a very modern resonance. What is really upsetting for us in Scotland is that we're not taught this as part of our history course. So everyone coming to the stories of the people killed as witches in Scotland are only finding out really through the stories that have been passed down, through finding out themselves, through asking why something's called the witch's wall and then finding out what happened to people. But there's no formal teaching of it. And in fact, I tweeted, if there was a museum of witch hunts in Scotland, would you come to them? And it was retweeted 1,200 times for people. People really want to know about their own history in Scotland. There's a real story under there about what actually happened at that time in Scotland that's much more dark, is equally as interesting, and no doubt people would want to watch it and read about it, of the real story of what happened to the people accused of witchcraft. And we'll learn how to dance and make our lives a film, the man starring you and me. We'll sail to an island on deep waters where the sun stays high and warms our cool pale skin, where no trouble fells our minds. It's just you and me this time. If we stayed here all the days, then that'd be fine. You and me. You and me. You and me. You and me.
That was Runaways by Ainsley Hamel, who was one of our featured sound articles in this issue, and I believe you wrote that one, Caitlin, is that correct?
Yeah, I did. I wrote that one, yeah.
It's her music is inspired by a community in Scotland called Govan, is that correct?
Govan, yeah. Each of the songs are kind of inspired by like a forgotten person or place within there. Apparently it's got quite a cast of characters.
Yeah, enough to fill an album at least.
It seems that way, yeah.
Yeah. So that was another article that you worked on for this issue. Let's pick it up again. What's an article that you didn't work on that you have some thoughts on?
I also liked there was another feature story. I think you wrote it about animation.
I did. Yeah. I've been wanting to write that article since the day I joined this magazine, because it's like, oh, there's a huge Irish animation industry and I love cartoons. So this is perfect.
Yeah. Like, how did that come to be? Because that's not something I would have ever thought of, right?
Well, that's the thing I learned about the history behind how it came to be. And it kind of came about through the demise of Don Bluth's career, to be a little morbid. I mean, he's still around, he's still doing stuff, but in his heyday, he had a studio, Sullivan Bluth Productions, set up in Ireland. And it probably for tax reasons or whatever, you know, all these industry places pick where they go and pick where they film based on finances as much as creative reasons. That studio animated a bunch of Don Bluth's major films, like The Land Before Time, The Secret of Nim, American Tale.
Oh, I love that one.
Oh, you know what? That's the one I haven't seen in ages. I need to catch that one again. But it was a lot of the work for those movies, at least on the animation side, was done in Ireland. And then around the time All Dogs Go to Heaven came out or was being worked on, there was a university in Dublin called Ballyfermot College of Further Education, and they started an animation school at that university in order to train, you know, more people to join that studio, and Glenn Murakami's studio as well was doing stuff out there. But that sort of ended up drying up in the mid-90s after things like Thumbelina and Rockadoodle came out and didn't do so well for Don Bluth. So by the time a lot of these college folks graduated with this degree in animation, there was nothing local to do anymore. So a few of them ended up starting up their own studios with different ideas in mind on how to service the industry. And that's proliferated in what's there today. And we interviewed folks from two different companies. One is Boulder Media, and they started out doing e-cards, of all things. Do you remember those?
Yeah. I remember those, yeah.
They ended up getting a job doing Foster's Home for Imaginary Friends.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Yeah, they actually, there's a really great story that the founder, Robert Cullen, told me. We'll use that as our interview then for that piece, because we're going to lead into that. After that took off, now Boulder is one of the biggest service animators in the industry, which is like, if I was Cartoon Network and I wanted to have a show about a certain property, I might hire someone like Boulder to animate it, which is how they get jobs. Like, one thing that was a big nerdy thing for me is that they do a lot of Transformer stuff right now. So people who don't know me, follow my Twitter and see how many robots I own.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And they're also doing the My Little Pony movie that was just recently announced.
Oh, that's fun.
He's directing it.
Oh, that's cool.
We interviewed Robert Cullen from that. And we also talked to Jerry Sheeran from Cartoon Saloon. He's more of the business side of things, but Cartoon Saloon, they took on a more daring niche to fill, which is the hand-drawn feature film sector. And one of their most recent films, Wolfwalkers, was just nominated for Best Picture, or Best Animated Picture, rather, and only lost by a hair to Pixar, but I mean, that kind of happens a lot. I watched it in preparation for this article. It's a great movie.
I will check it out.
And to that end, I have a bit of a clip here from my chat with Jerry Sheeran, where we talk a bit about some of the behind the scenes about how they do their animation, because it is traditional and it's hand-drawn, but obviously all these things use computers these days. And he told me a little bit about how they made something called Wolf Vision come to life, technically speaking. And as he said, it took 2 years to produce 2 minutes of footage. So let's listen to that. Yes. Another thing I wanted to touch on briefly is, I mean, this is a modern studio. You guys are making films today, But unlike a lot of them, you guys are working in 2D animation. Can you talk a little bit about what it's like to work in that medium when you go up against giants like the Pixars and Disney's that all use 3D?
3D. Yeah. So I think that Tom's, over the course of interviews that I've seen him do with Wolfwalkers, he's tried to redefine that discussion a little bit. Talks about the studio's work as being a hand-drawn work, as against being a computer-generated work. Albeit that now it's hand-drawn on a tablet.
That it's still computer-generated, but...
It's a hand-drawn, but it's not a computer-generated image. In the same way that you, like you said, when you talk about the 3D. So I guess it's part of the studio is its adherence to that type of animation art. So a hand-drawn animation art. You know, it's been brought forward by the technology and the tools that are available to it, but it's still the hand-drawn craft. And I guess then we're seeing by the industry a little bit to be that part of the industry is seen as, I would say, the craft part of the industry. It's funny, but in an appreciative way. Where we are in Kilkenny is, and one of the reasons why we fit so well in Kilkenny and that we're successful in bringing people here to work is that Kilkenny is the craft centre of Ireland. So it's a centre for ceramics and silverware and jewellery, and for music and for some other things as well, but definitely the headquarters of and the National Design Centre for Craft is all based in Kilkenny. So we fit right in there in terms of the small city that we're in. Mm-hmm. And there's an appreciation of our work as being that type of crafted work as well, even though it's still going out to a commercial audience.
Right. And I think, and this is just me kind of waxing my opinion of it, but I miss that kind of style, the 2D style that,
yeah.
I mean, there's no denying that they're doing amazing things with 3D these days, but like, especially with some of these films, the ones that Tom did, again, I can only speak to Kells and Wolfwalker, but it's designed almost to look like old manuscripts out of like ancient, like old books. And it's like, one thing that really struck me is that when you see Kilkenny in the distance in this movie, like there's not a perspective, it's just a flat image. And how it would have been drawn in like the 1600s or something.
Yes. So. And that was a big influence, is to they have that wood block style.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, what would have been drawn and printing in that time. And that's very specific because every new film that was done by the studio, albeit that they're all hand-drawn, they all have some new and unique process issues, in order to get across and to execute the sort of ambition of the director.
Mm-hmm.
And as it was in Wolfwalkers as well, both in the design style and then in the wolf vision.
Sequence
in the film.
That has a 3D vibe to it, and I was going to ask how that was done.
Yeah. Well, because I'm not the artist, I might be explaining it right, but it was something that was designed in 3D because it was designed in a sort of a virtual world with the headset on, and then from that, from what he designed there, taken out and hand drawn.
So they like rotoscoped it,
hand painted. To a degree, yeah, because you're talking about backgrounds. It's not, you're not talking about the human character, but then drawn with charcoal, and so it became that 2.5 minute sequence took us, 2.5 years to do it because it was so slow, and it was a discovery as it was going along because there was no plan as to how it was going to be finished.
Thank you. That was the main theme to Wolfwalkers by Bruno Culeas. It's, like I say, it's a great movie. I can't recommend it more. I don't want to say anything about the plot because the plot is the story, right? So go and see it.
Yeah.
Do you think you'll watch it? It's on Apple TV.
I'll watch it. Awesome. For sure.
It's really good. Another piece I worked on for this issue was I got to talk to Ken Casey of the Dropkick Murphys. Are you familiar with them?
Yes, I sure am.
That sounds like you're a fan. Tell me about that.
I wouldn't be so bold to say fan, but I am familiar with their body of work. And I have very fond memories of like Shipping Up to Boston, that one from like my youth, dancing to that in my friend's in my friend's kitchen to everyone's dismay. But I do like their songs. There's also one like, oh, something about a rose tattoo that I really like. Omar, my husband, really likes that song. So yeah.
Yeah, I'm kind of the same way. They're not somebody I listen to on the regular, but every time I hear them, it's always a fun time. They're very energetic, raucous. And let me tell you, Ken is probably the most Bostonian guy I've ever spoken to, and I've been to Boston. So he really lives that lifestyle.
Yeah.
Funny enough, even forming the band was, as he told me, done on a bet.
Yes, that was so interesting to read about.
Right? Like, isn't that a cool tidbit?
Yeah. I was like, that's really cool. You don't really think that to be the origin story for such a popular band.
You know what? For that band, it didn't surprise me, though. Like, you wouldn't assume it, but once you're told, you're like, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, right. That suits it, yeah.
I interviewed him for the Celtic Questionnaire, but because we have this podcast now, I actually asked him some exclusive questions that did not appear in print that we're going to cut to right now. So let's listen to our exclusive interview segment, or the rest of the interview, with with Ken Casey. So the rest of my questions here are ones specific to you and the release of this album. And my first one is, tell me a bit about the album and maybe some of the favorite tracks you have on it and what inspired them.
Sure. Turn Up That Dial is the name of the album. It's our 10th album. We've been together for 25 years this year, so we're celebrating that as well. Basically, Turn Up That Dial is kind of a celebration of just music and how we kind of had the time to re-fall in love with music again and be home playing vinyl front to back instead of listening to just songs here and there when you're in the car on the way to get a coffee or go to work or whatever it might be. And so given that time to listen to albums back as a whole, man, it brought back a lot of memories to when I was first falling in love with music. So and also just how music, you know, in the pandemic was such a great escape, you know, to be able to put the headphones on and close your eyes and just think about better days and other times and other places. And so there's a lot about that. And then the kind of secondary meaning to Turn Up That Dial was just, you know, we're hoping that this album is kind of the soundtrack to the release back to freedom, you know, and just turn up that dial on everything in life, going out and living life to the fullest. And, you know, and it also could be, you know, about speaking up, about, you know, turn up that dial on, standing up for what's right and speaking up and not, you know, just doing everything to the fullest, you know, whether it's a protest or a party or just playing your music loud. I would say as far as some of the favorite tracks, I'd say that the two that are specifically kind of related to music would be two of my favorites. Topically, that's Turn Up That Dial, the title track, which is more about like the band that inspired us as kids and stuff. And then Good as Gold, which is about kind of just buying vinyl, like when you were a kid and, oh my God, this new record came out and you couldn't wait to scrape a few bucks together and ride your bike to the record store and you know, buy an album and then get home and read every bit of the liner notes and everything. And so that's kind of two of my favorite songs on the album. Probably like the single that came out right at the start of the record, Queen of Suffolk County. I love that song. It's about Boston area women who are can be a little rough around the edges, so to speak. which has gotten me a lot of angry phone calls from girls I grew up with that think that maybe I wrote the song about them. came out to kind of think things through, rethink them, you know, in terms of like everything from what order the tracks are going to be in, everything like that. You know, usually in the rush to finish a record in between tours in normal times, there's always one or two things that I'll say, oh man, I wish I did that different on this record. And on this album, we don't really have that. I think it's because we had that little bit extra time to kind of think things through. And so it's nice to feel like you created like a complete album that you wouldn't change anything on. No.
You also happen to mention that this is your 25th year of the Dropkick Murphys. Tell me a bit of your thoughts on that, looking back on a quarter century of this group.
It really doesn't seem possible, to be honest. It was 25 years. It's like, how did that happen? It's just been a blur, a blink of the eye, and we all feel like so energetic and young and above the, you know, because I feel like playing music keeps you young, you know, young and hot. So we feel like, I don't understand. How did this happen? So we're in denial is basically the answer. But, you know, it is something to celebrate, and it's, you know, oftentimes we try to not let the band and being in a band dominate who we are, you know what I mean? Because I feel like people who place their whole identity on their band or any job, really, you know, could be a real letdown when that job or that band comes to an end. You know, I want to be the person I am, not just Ken from Dropkick Murphys. But when you start to think about 25 years doing something, you do have to stop and say, like, oh man, you know, this is my life. This is a huge part of my life. And yeah, it's okay to celebrate it, you know.
Subscribe to the horrors you preach, we repent.
So that was Turn Up That Dial, the title track on the new Dropkick Murphys album, in honor of our interview with Ken Casey and their 25th anniversary of the band. So congrats, Ken, wherever you're listening, because I assume you are.
I mean, of course he is.
So yeah, like, I mean, that's pretty much most of what we've got on the go for this episode of Clip. But before we tune out, is there anything else about this issue that really spoke to you, or anything you're excited about for the next issue, or ideas you have for this podcast? Answer any one of those three and I'll cut out whatever doesn't matter.
Oh gosh. I'm so excited that we're doing a podcast. I know it's been a thing that has been in the works for a while. Mm-hmm. And so it's so nice that we're finally doing it. And I loved this issue that we just put out. I thought it was a really interesting issue with a lot of interesting new things that we had never covered before.
I think that's a good point to mention, because again, we just had this meeting before recording with the team, and that seems to be the consensus that everybody on board is really excited about not only treading the same careful ground we've always treaded in the past, you know, tried and true, if it's not broke, don't fix it.
But, for sure.
Also, you're talking about some things that we may not have talked about before that are real issues that face people today. Like, I know last issue, Rebecca did a story on the queer culture in Celtic society and all that sort of stuff. And that was a big, you know, some people balked at that, but other people really appreciated our covering that. So I think I'm with you in that I'm really excited to see where Celtic life goes from here and the myriad stories we're going to cover.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I feel like there's a freshness to what we're doing. We've both been with Celtic Life for a few years now, and like this year the stories that we're putting out just feel fresh and new, and it's very exciting.
Mm-hmm. And for our listeners out there, of course, we're always interested to hear from you guys. What sort of stories do you want to hear from us going into the future? What topics have we not covered enough that we could cover more, because we're really excited and interested to expand just what Celtic means, not just to us, but to our readers and listeners as well. I think that really just about does it, except to once more thank our sponsor, She & Co. Travel. I've interviewed Genevieve, the founder and owner, before, and she's such a warm, lovely person. She takes a hands-on approach to travel. I haven't traveled with her personally yet, but I feel like if I did, I'd be in good hands. So if you want to think about how to get out to Ireland in the UK, give them a shout, because there are some fine people to help you find all the cool places. Caitlin, thanks again for joining us on this third edition. Do you have any parting thoughts?
No, I'm just so happy to have been included this time around. I hope to come back again. I had a lot of fun.
We're toying with the idea of a regular rotation of hosts, so I'm sure we'll hear from you again in the future. Stephen wants you and Rebecca to do one of these while drinking some white wine, so I wonder if that'll happen anytime soon.
I'm so down for that.
All right, well, thanks again everyone for listening. This has been the third episode of the Celtic Life International Podcast, aka CLIP, just giving you a slice of Celtic life. Ciao for now.